Well, hello. I'm Simon King, and this is Nature Space with Haydes. And today I'm with a very special guest of ours. I'll be chatting with Margaret Emerson. Hello, Margaret.
Hello there, Simon.
How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Weather's a bit miserable, but it's a good day.
Well, I have to say, I'm actually, and we should say for our listeners, I'm in sunny, not so sunny Lincolnshire today. It's very great. It's raining, so. And I'll explain that Margaret's down in Kent. So you've said it's not very nice there, but I bet it's better than it is in Lincolnshire. Let's leave it at that.
It's grey, it's misty, it's raining, and it's breezy, but it is mild.
Oh, we could almost be in the same office then. That's set the scene there for us. We've asked Margaret to join us. Margaret's, special guest, and she really is. Margaret has been a customer of ours for quite some time, and that's obviously appreciated, but things took an even more detailed turn, really, during lockdown and in the 2020, I think, when we launched our Armchair Naturalist project. And we put an invite out to our customers and invited them to write some blogs. Obviously, at that point, we were talking about the connection with nature. And we wanted to try and foster this connection, this community connection, where people could share what they could see. And Margaret, you took the challenge up, really, and I just want to applaud you, really, and say thank you. You've written over 50 blogs for us, for coming to us or giving us detail about your lovely garden in Kent. Thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Simon. Somebody said to me, that must take you quite a long time to write those. And I said, well, I usually dictate them into the computer, which is quicker than two-fingered typing. And I said, no, it doesn't, actually, because I'm just talking about what I've seen that week or month with the birds, and they just fascinate me so much. It was just like having a conversation with a friend, really. Oh, my birds have been doing so on. So, yeah, I've been pleased to be part of it.
It's funny you should say that. You know, when I read your blogs, it can, although we've never met before, and this is the first time we've talked, really, you know, having now met you, it's completed the picture. I can hear it's cathartic, actually, just reading the blogs as, when we are in our office and we're obviously doing what we can do to try and talk to more people about feeding the birds, it's great for this to come back to us, to mirror it back to us, so we can say, this is what our customer's garden, in this case, looks like. This is what Margaret's garden looks like. And actually, at a time when we ourselves were looking to remain motivated and to try and make sure that we were at the top of our game, really, during lockdown particularly, because I think it would be fair to say, Margaret and the team here would echo this. We had calls from people who were very upset, very concerned, and it became quite a lonely time for some people. And we wanted to be here to have that conversation with them, to say, look, you don't have to be ordering something. Talk to us, phone our helpline and have a bit of a chat. And actually, the team here, I know Angela, who you deal with very often, you know, Angela read your blogs, and they were very touching and remain so. So, you know, thanks for doing that for us. It makes a difference. And I think that's whenever you write something, you're not quite sure who's going to read it. But I just want you to know, we've read them and they're brilliant and beautiful.
Well, that's very kind, Simon. And I hope that being on your website, they made a difference to a few people as well during lockdown. I know one of my cousins used to say, have you written another one? Have you written another one? And he said, I've been making comments. Well, I could never read the comments, so I hope they were good ones.
They were good. I'll give you a definition of good in this case. I think it's always when people miss something, that's when it's really good. And I just want you to know, when you haven't written one, people miss it. And that's I think, is the nicest thing I can probably say, really. So it's missed when it's not there. So there
Thank
we go.
You. That's appreciated. Thank you very much.
I want to say to anyone listening, I had a sleepless night last night, really. I think Margaret knows where this is going. I wrote an email tonight. I said, don't worry, everything will be fine. We're only several podcasts in. It's our adventure, really, into finding out a little bit more about the bigger picture. We want to be a bird food company that doesn't just point fingers and say, you should be doing this, people should be doing that. We thought, we're going to do it ourselves. We are going to push the boundary out, find out more about things like climate change. We're going to find out more about biodiversity loss. We've interviewed people who've looked at the connection between nature and autism and so on. So I naively wrote an email to Margaret just saying, don't have a sleepless night, because I thought, well, perhaps Margaret's not done anything like this before. And then I had a lovely email back. Do you mind me saying?
Not at all, Simon. Not at all.
So I got a lovely email back from Margaret saying that she wanted to come clean, that in a professional life of almost 40 years, Margaret was a meteorologist. And for 15 of those years, Margaret was broadcasting as part of her role with the BBC local radio, and for a time on national radio, and then moved to the other side with the ITV and did occasional interviews. And also, I think you were saying that one of the scariest things you've done was being on live TV on the ITN lunchtime news during snowy weather and so on. So it's actually myself. I've had the sleepless night.
What
a wonderful career you've had there. Being a meteorologist, is that like being a scout? Once a scout, always a scout. Once a meteorologist, always a meteorologist. Must be.
Definitely, definitely. And the first thing you do, I started out as a weather observer while I was getting some qualifications. Then I moved into forecasting in various different roles. And the first thing a weather forecaster or a meteorologist does, you walk out the house, your head goes upwards, you're looking at the sky. And it's been said that that's the way, you know that person's a meteorologist because they're looking at the sky. Hopefully not followed by walking into a lamppost, but that's how it goes. But no, it never leaves you. I mean, I've been retired 3.5 years now, and I've still got my weather station in the garden, little manual station that I've had since 1981. And yes, I'm still interested in it. Obviously, the science and the technology is moving on. I've left. I'll be a bit behind the game now. But no, it never leaves you. Never leaves you at all. I'm sure it won't.
Fascinating. I think we'll come on to, the weather and whether you feel it impacts birds' appetite and so on. But the interesting thing for me there is that this is where your keen eye for observation comes from, isn't it? We talk about here at Hayes being a nature detective and so on. When you're observing the birds, you're not just feeding the birds and walking away and then not looking at them or your garden again. You're observing them.
Well, I am. Yes. I mean, at the moment, I'm sitting in my area that I call my office. And I'm looking out the window at a holly bush, and in a minute there might be a few sparrows hopping about out there. They're not at the minute, they're probably taking cover because it's so wet. But if I'm working on my dining room table, I'm looking out at the bird table. So I see all the antics that the birds are up to, and the squirrels, 3 squirrels come into the garden at the moment. So I watch them, and they make me laugh. And my cat, and don't worry, she doesn't go out and get the birds because she stays in the house, she's a house cat. She loves watching them as well. She'll be sitting on the window watching the squirrels, watching the birds. And, oh, it's lovely. Yeah.
One thing we talked a lot about in lockdown in 2020 was about the connection with nature, being connected with nature. Our gut feeling was that it could help people's well-being, it could help their mental health. And I think more recently there's been papers that have been written that confirm that. I mean, we're not the only ones who've thought this, by the way. I don't want to hold ourselves out as the only one who's thought this, but certainly it's become more commonly talked about. But I want to talk to you a little bit, if I can. Can you see that? Can you see that connection, how it changes the way you feel on a day-to-day basis, does it? You know, obviously, even your cat's behavior. Now, I've never thought about that before, but even your cat's behavior may change because of what happens in the garden as well. Do you feel that connectedness?
Well, I do. I mean, it might make me laugh because the squirrel's just gone and done something funny, or I'm watching the starlings and the feral pigeons having a bit of an argument about who's going to get in the bird bath or something like that. And I'm of an age where I remember the program on the television Animal Magic with Johnny Morris, where he used to put words into the animal's mouth. And I find I'm sort of, you probably saw that in my blogs, that I sometimes was imagining what the birds might have been thinking.
Yes.
He's gone over there. Has he got some food over there? Or I'm going over, oh, he's gone over, there's some water in there, you know. My sense of humour, perhaps.
I don't know. It's an interesting one. I remember Animal Magic, but also a friend of Hayes for quite a number of years, Bill Oddie. I've interviewed Bill before, really, and spent time with Bill. And he's, when he's recorded his piece, I think one of the amazing things he can do is really take that character of the animal that he's observing and bring it out in his own unique way. So I don't know whether it's part of growing up through that age, because I can hear Johnny Morris now, when you say that, but I can also hear Bill Oddie. But I guess I would also say, even if you weren't exposed to those programs, all the garden visitors do tend to have different personalities, don't they? Even if they're the same species. We hear from some of our customers who will say almost regular clockwork, for example, they'll see a male blackbird but it's not a male blackbird. It's the same male blackbird. And they're convinced it's the same male blackbird tapping on the garden window almost every morning, you know, just to say, look, you know, where is the food here? You know, how long do I have to wait?
Well, I think that is true. And I get quite a few feral pigeons come, and some of them are quite distinctive in colour. They're predominantly white birds. So I don't know if at some point they've crossed with a dove, but they're predominantly white and they've got different black or brown or grey markings as well. And so I do recognise those coming. Sadly, one of them who'd been coming for nearly 3 years suddenly disappeared. He's not coming anymore. And he was quite a character, because there's a few of them have worked out how to take the peanuts out of the peanut feeder, flip the lid up, and take them out the top. And there's only a few do it, and he was the first one. And then others were copying him and think, oh, but I called him the boss pigeon, because he'd be on there, get out the way, I'm having these peanuts, you know, and there'd be a bit of argy-bargy going on. And you mentioned about the blackbird, you know, a customer might have a blackbird knocking on the window. Well, I go out to my weather station every day at 9 o'clock. Now we're on back on GMT time, but and read my temperatures, my rainfall, and so on. And the birds know that they're going to have food topped up when I go out and do that. So I do my temperature readings first, come back in, get the seed, get the peanuts, whatever they need. And they've now started, some of them, following me down the garden, because they think I'm taking the food down to the weather station. And it's quite funny. I get mobbed by them sometimes. I've even had a pigeon land on my head before now. But it's just the way they are. And the little robin will appear. And I always say, oh, hello, Mr. Robin. You know, it might be a female robin. I don't know. But will appear. Oh, you're looking for some mealworms. Here's some mealworms. You know, haven't got one to come and feed from my hand yet, but you never know.
It's interesting you say that birds know, isn't it? And the following as well. I mean, although we kind of have this fine line between not wanting to domesticate them as such, but also we want them to know that a garden's a safe space and a reliable space for food as well. But they obviously do know. I mean, in my garden, I think that birds definitely do know when we are about to head out and fill the feeder. I can hear it. You can hear it really straight away. But they also do seem to know the difference between seeds as well in terms of variety. Could you talk us a little bit about that? I mean, just because it strikes me that you're in a perfect position really to kind of try and help and inspire and give a few words of advice for people who are maybe just starting on this journey of finding out what birds know and so on.
Yeah, of course, Simon. I mean, I feed a variety of food. I'm conscious of the fact that I don't want to attract rats to the garden. So majority of the food is in a feeder of some sort. So it might be a peanut mesh peanut feeder, a suet square in a little cage, wire cage, traditional ported seed feeders. But then I do scatter some seed, and I do scatter mealworms. Mealworms, the starlings know where they can come down for that. They've got some in a tray. I found they made too much mess with a feeder. So they have the variety of food. So there's always something there in the feeders, and I make sure I stock them up at the end of the day. The scattered food goes, so I don't have to worry about that. The pigeons will polish it off. And if the pigeons haven't polished it off, late in the day, a pair of magpies will come, two or three crows, and they'll, oh, there's some stuff here, we'll finish this off. So a variety of food. A close neighbour of mine, they put out Niger seed. I don't do that. So they are getting the goldfinches. I very rarely see them, but I do occasionally. They came, I had some teasel plants in the garden this year. They came for those, but now they've presumably gone back to the neighbours. I tend to get the bigger birds, but I've also noticed over the years the change in the types of bird that are coming, not just in response to what I'm putting out, but I've lived in this house over 50 years, so I've seen quite a bit of change in the environment around. But if I'd been doing the RSPB's Big Garden Bird Watch 15 years ago, probably the most populous bird in the garden would actually have been the collared dove. Well, when the feral pigeons moved in, the collared doves seem to have moved out, but I still get two or four of them coming. So there have been changes in the birds. I was shocked to read yesterday that the starling is on the red list for species. And yet I look out some days and I've got 68 of them sitting on the roof on the television aerial. So I'm presumably doing something right for them. but you know, there's certainly been some changes.
Yeah, it's interesting you say with starlings. When from when I joined Hayes back in the back end of 99 and early 2000s and so on, you know, there was a lot of talk in that maybe within the next 3 or 4 years. I was surprised really to read that starlings population was in decline even then, because we were also receiving more letters saying, what can I do to not feed the starlings? And that was an interesting thing, isn't it? Because the starlings in a way have been seen as like this boisterous species of birds that kind of arrive en masse, like some sort of motorbike gang or something. They descend on a feeder, don't they? And they strip it almost bare and then just go. And it's quite an interesting sight. And they're noisy too. So I remember people's letters saying, they are so noisy, you know, I do not want to feed starlings. And that's the thing in a way, isn't it? It's very hard to kind of pick and choose. I mean, starlings, back in the day, we used to find ourselves really doing a little bit of PR for starlings and saying, but have you seen them up close? You know, they're a marvelous color. They're this iridescent-y type thing, like an oil and water type. They're just a marvelous looking bird. But not everybody agreed. and it does make you wonder, doesn't it? Really, perhaps, you know, in the end, who are we to decide or to choose? I think when I've spoken to, say, Bill Oddie before, we've talked about, you know, which birds, you know, does he like and so on, which are the best looking and everything else. It's a really funny popularity. It's not a nice way to look at nature, really, I think is what I'm saying. And it is funny that in your garden, they're there. And has that got something to do with the fact, Margaret, that your garden is open for business and whatever turns up, it gets well looked after? Is that the case?
Possibly, yes. I mean, I think the variety of food helps and the variety of locations. I've even put up a new bird feeding station because I was conscious that the big birds were taking a lot of the food and the smaller birds, such as the blue tits and the robins, sparrows to some extent, weren't getting much of a look in. So I put this new feeding station up with peanut seed, and it's got a tray for putting loose stuff in. And I put it next to a hazelnut that I've got in the garden. And yeah, I've been seeing the blue tits going over, and oh, this is all right, we've got some peanuts. And the squirrel climbs up the pole and also gets the peanuts. But then I mentioned rats earlier on. I noticed a rat had got up the tree, up the hazelnut, and had gone along, it could reach the feeder. And I thought, well, I don't really want that going on. And I thought, well, it's only one. And then I saw two. And then there were a couple of youngsters. And I thought, where are they? Are they in my compost heap? But they don't appear to be. But all I've done is I've just moved the feeder pole a couple of inches. They now can't get up the tree to get to the feeder. I've not seen them for a week. So, you know, okay, they're part of nature as well. But I was getting something, I thought, well, I don't want a problem with the rats, because my neighbours had problems with rats a couple of years ago. And the pest controller came round and tapped at my door and he said, can I put a trap in your garden? And I said, well, yes. Do you see them over here? And I said, yeah. He said, can you take your bird food away for 3 weeks? Well, it's summer, and I said to him, it's summer, I'll do it. If you'd come and ask me in the winter, it would have been no. And he said, well, you're attracting them, it's a food source. And I thought, well, it's been out there in the garden for 45 years, we've never had problems with rats before. So I thought, not too sure. And then he said, don't put so much wheat out, suet's all right. I thought, well, there's never anything left at night that can be got at. So, yeah. So I think I've solved my rat problem.
Yeah, that's interesting. The previous podcast, I interviewed ISNR veterinary advisor, Professor John Cooper, to come and talk to us about avian flu and how we might continue to feed the birds. And he came up with a couple of good words, because he said that there was an overwhelming benefit to continuing to feed wild birds, even with the current outbreak of avian flu. But he did say the important words for him were sensibly and sensitively. And sensibly, I think, would be, you've already cracked that one, which is, you know, observing, back to the rat anecdote, really, which is, we've spotted something. So sensibly, you found a way to resolve that. And so you move the feeder, and that's going to resolve that. Sensitively, he talked about being aware of our surroundings. So, for example, you've already mentioned that anything that you put on the ground or anything you put out, it's gone in that day. So you're actually feeding kind of a day's servings, really, rather than, you know, we are aware some people will put a heap of bird food out and empty a 5-kilo bag on the ground and walk away from it, which we think is a real shame because, you know, part of some people are, I don't know, maybe our competitors would say, well, what are you talking about? You know, at least they've bought the bird food and thrown it out, but we don't want that. You know, if food is so expensive, you know, we want it to be, and it's not just about feeding the birds. Yes, one thing we, Professor Cooper talked about was, yes, it's good for the birds if we feed them sensibly and sensitively, but also it's good for us. And just piling a heap of bird food, enough for a week or 2 weeks, and watching it degrade and walking away, turning our back to wildlife, really is, we're missing a trick if that's done. But you don't. You're observing, you're fine-tuning, you're adjusting. And I imagine the weather's changing as well. Well, obviously the weather's changing, but how your approach to feeding the birds also probably changes with the weather. You've mentioned summer and obviously winter. You know, we're finding in my garden, and have done for a few years now, June, July can be amongst the busiest time in my garden for feeding the birds, just because of the amount of fledglings that we have. Goldfinches in our garden, and when they arrive with their families, you know, it's it's like Alton Towers. have you seen an increase in those summer months?
I think I have, because I think in the past it would have been birds on the feeders or at the bird table looking for food in the cold weather, and then they'd gone off to the countryside, many of them, during the summer. And yes, I do see a bit of a decrease, but not with the starling, because that's when the teenagers, as I call them, have turned up. They're youngsters. And back in the early part of the summer, I thought, how many are out there? And there were some adult birds. And I thought, there's 24 youngsters out there today. I actually looked out the window and I said, best of luck to you. I hope you make the winter. And they were all there. And then, you know, as I say, 68 on the roof. That is the record. They must have been short of food elsewhere that day. But I think they are there constantly. The jackdaws disappear. They're there in the spring and they're there in the autumn and the winter. They tend to disappear in the summer, apart from the two who seem to be living in my chimney pot. I think they are. I don't know what they've done inside. They must have built themselves a little platform somewhere. The blackbirds tend to disappear a bit. So I do see variation, but they're certainly back in force now. Yes. And it's not been cold.
It's been very mild, isn't it? I mean, do you find, if I watch the gardening programs, you know, I watch Monty Donny and he'll say, these are the things you want to be doing, you know, as back end of summer into autumn. What's happening in your garden? I imagine you're preparing for autumn and winter, but you're also trying to do that sympathetically back to this sensibly thinking about things you move. I'm not trying to put words into your mouth, but I'm looking at your blogs here and I'm thinking, you're not just making this look like a, you know, a kind of a blank canvas. You're trying to not undo the good that you've done throughout summer. So what tips, what will you be doing as, you know, autumn unfolds in order to keep your garden right for birds?
Well, I'm not somebody who goes mad on tidying up, and birds and insects as well. I'm not somebody who wants my lawn looking like a bowling green. So it will have dandelions in it. It will have daisies in it. And I don't care. I mean, I might try and take the dandelion clocks off before they go and spread everywhere. So I don't go mad on tidying up. I tend to leave some of the plants unpruned, for example, columbine, which might have some seeds in it. I've still got some teasels left in the garden. Okay, my hazelnut is full of ivy, but I don't mind. And somebody said, oh, you want to take that down? And I said, well, a hazelnut that's been, I can never remain locked back, hasn't got any weight to it. So if a branch were to fall down, would it matter? It's not like a big tree coming down on my house. So I've left the ivy for the birds. I rake my leaves up off the lawn, but I leave them in the flower beds. I've got about a quarter of an acre, I suppose, of garden. For these days, for a house, is probably quite a lot. But, you know, I leave some of it. And somebody said, oh, I want to prune these bushes for you. Somebody comes and helps. I said, no, leave it. I said, the front garden, part of it is on the slope. Leave it. That's a little nature reserve almost. They can go in there and do what they like. You know, so that's my approach to it. Making sure over the winter that the birds have got water still. And over the summer, that was a big thing. I was actually having to fill, I've got big plant saucers, 12-inch plant saucers. I was having to fill them 2 and 3 times a day in the summer. So always make sure that that's there and cleaned, rinsed out every day, possibly topped up late afternoon. So the bathers, before they go off for the night, the starling bathers, they seem to have their bath about half three in the afternoon and then go off for the night. I always make sure they've got clean water. So, you know, clean the feeders from time to time. Sweep out the, if there's any surplus old seed left in the bird table, you know, just the little things that I can do that will help.
I love that you call them bathers.
it is like a little family group. Right, go on, kids, go and have your bath now before you go to bed. And they're all in there and, you know, and then a pigeon comes over and, get out, I'm in here.
Do you think people miss a trick when they don't put water out? Because I think the assumption is, particularly I think throughout autumn and winter, that there's going to be plenty of water, so we don't need to put water out. But I agree with you, it is exactly the opposite. And as the weather gets cooler as well, then, and obviously freezes, then it can be even harder for birds to find fresh water. But they miss a trick, don't they? Because to watch birds bathing and congregating, it's fascinating, isn't it, that water?
It is. And the I don't notice it so much with the starlings, but the feral pigeons, they'll go in and have a bath, and obviously there's water going everywhere, and then they sit on the lawn to dry off and they've got their wings out a bit and then they go off. The starlings just bathe and that's it, off they go. That's quite funny to watch. Yeah.
I love that. It's you know, it should be broadcast on the internet full time, shouldn't it? Really, it is fascinating to watch that. I think we've touched a bit there on hygiene as well, and obviously one thing we're really keen to do is promote good hygiene at feeders. How do you go about keeping your bird feeders clean, Margaret?
I have a routine where I will empty a seed feeder with the feeding port. I'll empty it out completely because they do sometimes get rain in and block the bottom port. Empty it out completely, use some disinfectant spray, and then put it back out so they get done. If there is any old seed, not that it very often is left in the bird table, and it's getting a little bit, it's got wet and it's in a mess, I clear that up as well, because I've actually put in the bottom of my wooden bird table a piece of board so I can lift that out and clean it. But sometimes you get seed guts underneath it, so it needs a bit of attention. Seems to be a magnet for earwigs as well, actually.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's interesting that you say about. So you've got some sort of contraption that's capturing any waste husk. Not the nicest thing to talk about, but obviously bird feces as well and so on, yes, potentially. Yes. Now that's a great idea, particularly during, you know, any outbreak of avian flu and so on, because getting those off the bird table makes great sense.
So I'm conscious of, well, I don't want to have a problem with the birds coming, and I'm always on the alert. I've never seen any birds that look unwell in a group, so I'm on the alert for that. And if I did see some that looked as if there was a problem, you know, I'd alert somebody to that fact. But I think it's important. I mean, you don't want to be attracting the birds, but then doing them harm at the same time. Because over the years, and I've not seen any in the garden for a number of years now, green finches, used to have a lot of green finches. And they've suffered, haven't they, with a virus or an illness that's affected them. So I don't see those at all now.
Trichomoniasis,
they were regular visitors. Bullfinches used to be probably 40 years ago. Don't see those at all now.
Do you see, you've said you've lived where you've been for 50 years, so I guess you probably would have seen, like most of us have seen, that the areas around our gardens become more homes, more industry, more commercial, and so on. So I suppose some of those, but the bullfinch, for example, that, you know, that I see as a traditional country dweller, but possibly venturing into our gardens to eat, consume seed heads and so on. But they've got to be in the area to start with. They won't just pop into our gardens from some mile away. What's interesting, Margaret, we interviewed a doctor at the Institute of Zoology who'd just written a paper recently about the subject of rewilding. And she would be very proud of you for not having manicured grass, by the way.
I wouldn't have time to have manicured.
You would be getting 10 out of 10, really, for blowing those leaves back into the border rather than picking them up as well, because you can imagine what insects and invertebrates and so on will live there throughout the year. So that's fine. And her research shows that, and her team's research shows that rewilding can actually help, and this is coming back to what we've talked about really in terms of studying the weather and so on, is that rewilding can actually help combat some of the worst of climate change and biodiversity loss. So this is a really interesting point, because it brings us a little bit full circle to where we started. But the other thing really about that is that by leaving these areas of space in our gardens that we become less precious over and less cosmetically worried about, turns out are much better for wildlife than we've ever thought. So even a small space, but also back to our bullfinch, is that what our gardens, we're understanding now, are becoming these stepping stones for nature. We've heard about wildlife corridors as well. And we at Hayes would like to think that this is one of the reasons, or one of the other reasons really, Margaret, why talking to yourself is brilliant, because we want people to understand that, yes, it is their own garden, and they are, I think it's fair to say, some people say, these are my birds, and we write back to them and say, your birds, and that's fine, you know, they're yours. But I want our customers, and even people who aren't our customers, to understand that actually everybody's gardens, in a way, have become these stepping stones, and combined, they become this superhighway for nature to make its way up and down the countryside. And so that they can find then core pieces of habitat, which is probably where the wildlife trusts and the RSPBs and so on are investing in huge land space and developing it, or not developing it, but creating habitat which is safer for a larger amount of birds. But our job in our own gardens is to offer this highway. Some birds will stay either in our gardens or in that locale. Others will make their way through the countryside. I went to a fascinating presentation at the Linnean Society in London, where I'm a fellow, and they talked about butterflies and how they're making their way up the country from south to north in the UK. As the weather patterns are changing, as it's becoming warmer, then the food sources, the plants and so on, beginning to actually grow slightly further north. I mean, we're talking about inches and so on, but over obviously years and years and years, it's starting to add up, so that butterflies are making their way to the north. So I just want to say that it's your good self and, you know, people who feed the birds who are creating those stepping stones. So individually doing a great job in your garden, but all these garden spaces added together are making a huge difference. They have to.
I'm sure they are. I mean, it's I don't know where my flock of starlings
they're yours. They're yours.
I know they roost in the neighbours about four or five doors away. They roost in there where they are with the youngsters. But I see them fly off now, and they're going off into some woodland that I can see that's about a mile away. And they're doing their, well, not quite a murmuration, but they're all gathering together in the evening. I think, right, that's it. They've gone for the day now. The pigeons seem to come from different areas, because some go earlier and they fly in towards the town centre. So I always say to myself, well, they're going for their fast food in the town for tea. And others go off another way. And I assume the collared doves are more local, because they'll be out there probably only about 10, 15 minutes before sunset. Blackbirds and robins around later. But yeah, so they're round and about. I think there's some robins and blackbirds nesting in my neighbour's garden in a bush where they can't go out of my garden. Don't think any of the birds last winter took advantage of my two bird boxes. I could be wrong, but I don't think they did. And, well, I did have a bee hotel in the garden, but that fell off the fence during the winter, so I'm not sure that did too well either. But, yeah, little differences. I mean, I know my neighbours said to me it would be better if the feral pigeons weren't here. And you think, well, okay, but they're coming here for a reason, and I think they protect the smaller bird. I may sound a bit weird, but the pigeons just all suddenly take off because something spooked them, upset them. And all the little birds then know that they can get away into the bushes because they've seen the pigeons go.
I mean,
that may be wrong, but I think they protect them. I do sometimes get a sparrowhawk in the garden. So the little birds have got the pigeons almost as bodyguards in a way, because they do mix around.
And these are the things that you spot as an observer, really, of nature. You know, back to the point before, being this nature detective, you're spotting these things.
Yes, I think so. And somebody, one of my neighbours said to me, you know those pigeons who come to you? And I said, yes. He said, why do they all suddenly fly off, he said, and do circuits and then come back down again? I said, I have no idea, but they do it. Sometimes it will just be one circuit round the house, back on the roof. Other times they're doing it going round and round and round. So probably they've seen something they don't like. And he said, but they're always on your half of the roof because I'm a semi-detached house. And I said, yes, I know they are. Another funny story. I had a roofer came to do some repairs. And he said to me, oh, yeah, it doesn't look as if there's much doing. He had a specific job to do. I'll give a quick check. And he said to me, have you had the moss taken off your roof? Because the neighbours have got a lot of moss and I haven't. I said, no, it's the pigeon. He said, what do you mean? And I said, well, they've been running up and down the roof. I said, all the moss has come off. They went in the gutters and blocked the gutters, but that was that's a different thing. You can have that clean. And they've started doing it now on the front of the house as well. So there's moss everywhere. They've just knocked the moss off. Their little feet running up and down.
I've seen them before taking moss off out of hanging baskets for their nests and so on. My wife's put them up before and then come back and said, I don't know what's taking this kind of, you know, sphagnum moss or whatever it is these days, but it's going. And then every now and again, you'll see a bird that looks like it has a mustache. And culprit number one,
they are funny. And as mentioned, I get crows in the garden. I don't put bread out very often. But if there's a lot of pigeons there, they might get a slice of bread out there and it'll go. So I know it's not hanging about. But the crow will come, take a piece and put it in the bird bath, wet it and then eat it.
Really?
And weird things like that. I've seen them do it in the gutters as well. If the gutters have got water in them. So, I mean, they're adapting to, a gutter. A bird bath isn't part of nature, but they know how to do that. And the crow, one of the crows also knows that if the squirrel is on one of the peanut feeders where they rip the mesh, the squirrel will go for the peanut and chances are one will fall on the ground as well. So he can dart in and get a peanut. They're incredible. Very clever animals, I think. Birds. They're very clever. We say bird brain, but I think that is really offensive to them. Because they have an excellent bird brain.
I think I remember reading one of your blogs when you said about, I think the squirrel was caching the peanuts and it was being observed at the same time. Yeah. Yeah. I've seen that on a couple of TV shows, really, where they show squirrels caching the peanuts and they're being observed by another squirrel, in this case, who then goes along and unearths it and so on. But the same happens in my garden. I mean, I don't know what the squirrel thinks it's going to do because I'm sure it never finds them, it's obviously in their DNA and they're going to cache the peanut and it makes them feel better about the weather changing.
I don't think they come back for many of them, or I wouldn't have so many hazelnuts trying to grow in the garden, and peanuts coming up in containers, the lawn, the flapping.
in this economy, Margaret, it must make them feel better that they've got a few peanuts banked for later in the year when it gets tough.
Oh, strange. I mean, because they're just random. They're digging little holes in the lawn and burying the nut. And it's when they pat it down with the front paws. Really is. Pat the soil down. They're doing it for ages. Fascinating.
They do that for us, you know. It's like, look, you watch me, I'm going to reward you with this. Because that's when it's magical, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Is it?
Not so good when they dig my plants up, but there we are.
No, it's not. No, not when they're at the bulbs. It's not. No. Can you talk to us about bird food? Obviously, you know that we go to great lengths to super clean, not just clean. But do you think that makes a difference? Do you agree that it's? And I know it's a loaded question, really, but we'll take it on the chin at Hayes. Does good bird food make a difference?
Well, I think so, because I notice with your sacks of food, if I'm got a partially, you know, sacks almost finished, and I'm tipping the residue into a new sack, that I'm not getting clouds of dust coming up. The peanuts, there's no sign of mould on them. I must admit, I normally buy my mealworms elsewhere. I found a source for a 5 kilo bag. A little dismayed, though, when one of the bags, I found a cigarette butt in the bag. And I thought, that's not very good.
Mm.
And they'd come from been produced overseas but sold over here, and the cigarette butt was obviously from the country of origin, and you think that's not very good. So I think your seed is certainly very good quality, and I think it does make a difference. If I've got a bit short of seed, haven't been able to get an order in time, I've bought some somewhere else, goes much more quickly because it obviously isn't very good. And one of your bags of seeds I'm using at the moment, Squirrel says, thank you very much. There's some sunflowers, shelled sunflower hearts in here. This is good. So he's having those. So, yes.
It's funny you should say that. You've tried the no-mess mixes then, like so sunflower hearts or maybe our husks we advanced, so they don't have any husks on, and there's benefits there. It's interesting because some people might think if a food goes faster, they might think, oh, the birds must really like it. But what we know is, obviously, a seed mix with more calories means that the birds need to consume less in order to feel full. So it's just the difference between a good meal and not so good meal. You know, a large bird eating very basic food, which may contain almost only wheat, will have to get through an awful lot of wheat in order to, for example, you know, compared to a sunflower heart, which is no shell, and has got probably about the same amount of calories as a Mars bar. So it's a big difference. You can't eat many Mars bars, and that's probably, you know, where we are. But the squirrel likes them without the husks on.
Oh, yeah, well, there's less effort. He can just sit there and have a tuck in to get his energy up for burying all the peanuts. I imagine he's doing.
It's the circle of life.
Well, yeah, he was sitting in the little tray where I'd put some mealworms and a bit of seed. And I thought, to now, and he was sitting there, and the little paws were going. And I thought, you're having the sunflowers, aren't you? And then he went off, and he was having some more peanuts. And one the other day was sitting on the top of my wooden compost bin, looking at me round the hazelnut. And I thought, the feeder was empty. You're waiting to see if I'm putting peanuts out, aren't you? So I said, hello, Mr. Squirrel.
Oh, it is funny, isn't it? And this is the thing, you know, this is what people can miss if we only feed the birds. The other side of this, it's good for the birds, that's the food, but it's good for us if we don't turn our back on feeder once it's full and just take a few moments, put the kettle on, take a few moments and just observe. And that's where the beauty and the magic happens, really, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I mean, you say sit, get back inside and watch them. With the starlings and their mealworms, I won't have got back inside before they're down for them. It's a time of day when they're about. And it goes. I get inside and then you think, they've had that lot already.
Well, you know, they're on the red list. So this is the thing now. They're in your garden, hopefully for good. And it's interesting, isn't it? Do we change our approach when we spot that they're on the red list? I guess, you know, we have to feel to ourselves, you must be doing something right. Is it food? It's the water. And I suppose we're blessed by maybe things in the countryside that work in their favor as well. So we're never quite sure what will turn up. But I think perhaps when whatever does turn up, we need to look after them, don't we? And then it's interesting that you've spotted that the starlings, because you would never know that they're in fewer numbers, because as I say, and as you say, when they arrive, they look like a gang. They have,
oh, yeah,
and they have purpose.
Serious stuff, yes, when they arrive. But no, I mean, in this area, you wouldn't think there was a problem with starling at all. But, you know, it's just lucky that that little group has obviously found the right environment. I'm not very far from the countryside. About a mile down the road, there's quite a bit of trees, a bit of woodland, heathland, and so on. So, I mean, they're probably, this particular area where I live, most of the houses have been here 60 years, 70 years. There are newer ones around. So it's probably fairly well established area. And I'm only a couple of miles from the North Downs. So, you know, there's things there.
It's a lovely part of the country, isn't it? Yeah.
It is. I mean, it's not called the Garden of England for nothing. It's, yes, it is beautiful. And I can, from my upstairs window where I'm sitting now, well, if it wasn't so misty, I can see round three sides onto the North Downs. Beautiful view. Beautiful view. Obviously, you can watch the weather as well. So
fantastic. I should tell you before, and then probably I'll leave you then to go and look after those starlings. We're, I think you'll have seen our blogs and so on, just informed that we're moving from our current place here in Grimsby. Mm. We're moving to Louth, which is the next town, really. It's a lovely market town. It's on the edge of the Lincolnshire Wold. One thing we'll be doing, and this is a promise for you, Margaret, as well, we're certainly not a company that's going to be pointing fingers and saying, you know, you must do this in your gardens. We're going to give more commercial space back to nature. So we've got a 2-acre plot, and around about 20-ish% of that plot's going to be handed back to nature. So we're going to be looking at rewilding, planting native pieces of trees. You've already mentioned how important trees are in your garden, but we're going to be dedicating some of that space and just leaving it. We've got wildlife attenuation ponds, so we're going to tick the fresh water box as well. And we're going to be looking to increase the net biodiversity of that site so that by the time we've built on it and then planted on it, there will be more nature on there than was on there before we started the project as well. And we'll be creating lots of space for our teams as well. So Angela, who I know you deal with, you know, Angela and the team will be able to go and have a break with nature. So they'll be part of this. And we'll create a stepping stone, obviously, on our plot and our commercial space for nature, that nature can come and visit us or come and make its home and find its way, you know, up and down the country from there. So all our gardens, and we want to encourage, you know, commercial companies as well to do the same. You know, why not make space for nature in our commercial backyards as well? And then we can put all this space together, attract, help, retain sensibly and sensitively, look after more wildlife. And then we've all got skin in this game, really, which is, you know, in the end, it's a fantastic and rewarding hobby, isn't it, really?
Oh, it is. I'm talking about, you know, biodiversity and things like that. I was a meteorologist. I was actually with the Met Office, so, you know, the state provider of weather services, and our headquarters moved down to Exeter onto a brownfield site a couple of miles out of the city. But the site was put in with biodiversity in mind. A few years later, the trees have grown up, there's a pond, they do surveys of the wildlife and trying to be, you know, as environmentally friendly with it as they can be. And you'd think, well, that's a big organization, has done something, built a massive building on this brownfield site, but nature's still got its place. And I don't know how many species of animals are now in the environs, but yeah, very important.
That's a lovely way to leave things, really. Nature's still got its place. I think they're going to ring in my ears, actually, because nature very much will have its place. It should do. We're a wildlife company. It should do anyway. But, you know, really, we're going to make sure it does have its place. And perhaps you can come and see us up in Lincolnshire when we're establishing things. If you fancy a journey up this way, it'd be great to see you.
Yes,
okay, Margaret, yes. I'm going to say goodbye, and I'm going to leave you if there's anything you want to summarize with. But from my perspective, and obviously the teams here, we want to say thanks for taking up the challenge, really, writing those beautiful blogs. please continue doing so. We really invite you to continue doing that. And I would like to say that obviously those blogs have helped us as a company, and we know others have read them as well. So they've resonated with other people, and the work you do to make space for nature in your garden is certainly inspiring. And over to you, Margaret, really. Anything you want to leave us with?
I think I'll go back to something that my late mother said. She used to feed the birds when I was working. Now they're spoiled because I can feed them 10 times a day. And she said, wouldn't it be a terrible world if there were no birds? And, you know, she said, the blackbird's out there singing again. And she said, oh, he's up there in the thing. There's a robin there, came out. You know, and I think she's right. And the birds need us. We need the birds. And we need all the elements of nature. We need the bees. We really need to be doing something for the poor old bees as well. Otherwise, I think mankind will be in a bit of a state. Do your little bit. You don't have to have a massive garden. A feeder will do. Put in a safe place. Mixture of food. And enjoy, I think, is my message.
Thank you, Margaret. That's brilliant. Well, I'm Simon King. This is Nature Space with Hayes. It's been my pleasure to talk with Margaret Emerson. Margaret, thank you very much. I will just say, to put you under a little bit of pressure, perhaps if you've got some time for us, maybe we should check in with you in winter, if that's okay.
Yes, of course.
Oh, wonderful. Now, we've recorded that, so, you know.
No getting out of it, no.
Well, if have a think about that, but if you're happy to do so, I'll check in with you during winter and we'll find out what's happening in the bird garden there. But thanks ever so much.
I could let you know if the redwings have come back. They didn't last winter, but winter before, lots of redwings. My first time with those in the garden. So that's the holly bushes. The berries
fantastic.
On the holly bushes.
Oh, that's the secret. Yeah. So that's bringing the winter thrushes potentially. Oh, leave us on a cliffhanger. I like that.
Yes. Will I see them this year?
Okay, Margaret. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.